Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them an unexpected twist. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, "The bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve." These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and to flourish. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need help with your own personal navigation and you're in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, 2ManageVets Consulting. Enjoy the bend and be inspired by our wonderful guest. Welcome. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's version of The Bend. I am smiling a lot today because today I'm going to have on somebody who we laughingly call sisters from another mother. Julie Squires is with us. Now, Julie has been in the veterinary profession for over 25 years. She was a trainer for Nestle. She was a hospital administrator. She does some fun stuff like being a tour guide for the Catskill Animal Sanctuary. And she is certified in compassion fatigue, and she is a certified life coach, which is where she is spending her time right now. So, Julie, welcome, and thanks for being on The Bend today.
Well, it is an absolute pleasure. I'm so excited to be here and just chat about life and vet med and whatever we're going to talk about. I don't even know.
You know, we're going to talk about the bends in the road, because I think that's one of the things that you and I both had some experience navigating. And hopefully talking about that a little bit will help some folks that maybe need a little coaching, a little guidance. And of course, that's exactly what you do. So tell us a little bit about how you got started in vet med.
Jeepers, creepers. Well, it's very funny that before we started to record, we were talking about Oswego, which is where I went to college, which is where I studied zoology. Debbie, like, I just had that love of animals. You and I talked about it earlier. Like, I just have loved animals since I was born. I was born to love animals, and I didn't know how to make a career out of that. Like, you would think I would normally have thought to become a veterinarian, but I didn't. So I went and studied zoology, got out of college, couldn't find a job because no one was advertising in the newspaper wanting to hire a zoologist in upstate New York. Wanted.
Yeah. Like being a wildlife veterinarian, like, really?
Right. So what did I do? I waited tables. That's what I did. I went to the Adirondacks, to a tourist community, and waited tables, and then thought, oh boy, you know, this is fun, but really I don't feel like this is my passion. I had this really cool opportunity in college. I did an internship at a wildlife rehabilitation center, and that stoked the flame for me of really like immersing myself and wanting to help animals. Then I did answer a newspaper ad to work in a veterinary hospital, starting as a receptionist, but that's how I weaseled my way into vet med. That's how it all began, as a veterinary receptionist. Hardest job in the world.
Amen. Amen. You know, it's I've taught CSR skills for many, many years for Patterson, and I was shocked one day when I was talking about how important this role was, that somebody came up to me and she said, "Debbie, I've been working in animal hospital for 25 years and you're the first person who ever told me I was important." I just about started to cry. I thought, God, you are the key to the kingdom, don't you? I mean, I hope you understand that, because if the CSRs don't do their job well, then none of the medical team gets to, because people won't even come in the door, or you've turned them away right there at the beginning. Tell me about, you know, your journey in vet med, because then you were a hospital administrator, obviously moved up in practice.
Well, I moved in the back is what I did. I didn't move up. I moved in the back. I was like, okay, sure. I'll, you know, work in the front, and I learned all the things, and I didn't know anything. And I didn't know, this is so long ago. I don't, you know, you and I, we've got war stories, but it's like, I had to learn. I didn't even know what heartworm disease was. I didn't know what feline leukemia. Had to learn the products, which at the time were Adam's Flea Dip and Carbam.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I know, I'm old. So I immersed myself in learning. And then finally I really made a pitch to the veterinarian who was kind enough to hire me. And I said, I really want to work in the back with the animals. And he gave me a chance. And again, I was like a sponge. I learned everything I could. I wanted to be so good at it. I wanted to anticipate. He taught me to anticipate what he needed. So, you know, working as a veterinary assistant was amazing and fun. I loved all the moments of it, except for the moments that were emotionally hard.
Yes.
And I ended up leaving after about 5 years, the practice, got into industry, worked for some of the major companies out there, started with a distributor. Who did I go? Then I went to IDEX, then I went to Bayer, then I went to Purina. And oh, before Purina, I came back, you know, that's always been my veterinary hospital and I've always been super connected with them. And my old boss was looking for a hospital administrator. And I was like, you know, I could use some management experience. So maybe we make this work. That got me into the management side of things. And so he hired me again. He hired me twice.
Never burn your bridges, right?
That's right. So he hired me twice and I quit on him twice. But may he rest in peace. He was my mentor. He was everything to me. He just passed away, unfortunately, in October. And, you know, he taught me a love of veterinary medicine. There's no question about it. And he also showed me the emotional strain. I didn't know what to call it. The first time I worked for him, we didn't have the term compassion fatigue, but I saw the toll that vet med took on him personally, professionally. And the second time I went to work for him, when I managed his practice, I did that because his wife, who was in her 40s, was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. And I supported him to the best of my ability as he went through that loss. And it was, I will tell you, I can speak about this now, but it's like, it showed me also all of his regrets. He had a lot of regrets because he spent so much time in that dang practice and missed a lot of the family and being able to spend time with his wife up until the end.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Again, going back to parallel journeys, I started as a CSR part-time, left after 6 months because, you know, I was going to start basically at minimum wage. And then was hired back as the hospital administrator by the same boss. There we go again. So let's talk a little bit about your curveballs. What has been your toughest challenge in life through all these transitions?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, I would say that my toughest challenge in life through all of this stuff is like, I guess I feel like there's so many. I feel like my road has been, you know, I feel like, I don't know. Have you ever been on the road to Hana?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. My husband calls it the road to hell. It's 300 switchbacks. Yes.
It's awful. You'll only ever want to do it once and you'll never recommend to anyone to do it. You're right. It is the road to hell. I love that. I feel like that's been my life's journey, like on the cliff half the time and like wondering if we're going to drive off of it. But I suppose my biggest curveball as of late, I mean, I would say there's two main ones. My two main switchbacks would be the day I got laid off from Purina, again, worked for them for 10 years. This is after I was a hospital administrator, went back, was doing corporate training, got laid off. And that propelled me to start this business. Mm-hmm. So I'd say there's that. And then most recently, last April, when my mom died suddenly. So that would be my other huge curve in the road for me. Like, you know, the things that surprise us out of life we didn't expect.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about getting laid off because you and I have both been there and you know, you kind of, your self-esteem is a little crushed by it, even though you look back and you go, I really didn't do anything wrong. It was the circumstances of the economy, basically. But then you're like, you know, you almost have to rethink about yourself and then what you're going to do next. And it, to me, I look back on it and it's like, getting kicked out of the nest, like as a baby mm-hmm. bird, you know, you're going to sink or fly and you better fly. Yeah. So how did you feel when that happened to you?
Well, I was crushed. And it's funny because I was crushed, although it's like, got to be careful what you ask the universe for, because you often will get it. And I had been miserable in my job for a while. And it is these challenges, you know, the golden handcuffs are real. Mm-hmm. You have a great salary, you have perks and expense accounts and 401ks. But yet there was this yearning and longing inside of me to do something much bigger, but I was afraid. I was deathly afraid. So I was miserable. I was drinking an awful lot. I was trying to drown all my sorrows in wine. And I was miserable. I felt emotionally and physically not good. And when I got laid off, I mean, I was devastated because, like you said, I was kicked out of the nest and I was devastated. It's almost like when, remember back in our dating lives, when, you know, you broke up with someone, it was like, you want to be the one to break up with them. You don't want them to break up with
yes.
you.
Yes, exactly.
I want to be the rejector, not the rejectee. Mm-hmm. It's like one thing if I walk in and say, peace out, people, I'm done here. But they said that to me.
Yes. Yes.
And here is the quintessential question, though. I mean, I cried. I mean, right in the meeting, I have no shame. I like cried. It was tough. It was a tough meeting. It was tough for the person who had to deliver the news. And we were at a national sales meeting. And I then went from this meeting room where both myself and my colleague were told that the department was, they were getting rid of this particular department. And I was on my way up to my hotel room, back to my hotel room. And I remember waiting for the elevator and like all the thoughts are going through my mind. What am I going to tell my husband? How am I going to live? Are we going to be in a van down by the river, you know, living with our cats and our dogs in it? And then I asked myself this really important question. And the question was this, what am I going to make this mean about me? Like you said, am I going to make this mean that I have nothing to offer the world, that I'm a failure? Or am I going to make this mean here's an opportunity to perhaps do something different, do something else, mm-hmm. which is what I did.
Do something big. You know, that's yeah. the thing. You kind of look at it big. It's, I'm sure you've had other opportunities after starting your business. And I know I did. People would come to you and go, hey, well, how about running this hospital? Or how about being involved in this group? And I went, no, you know, I'm done with that. I really am. Mm-hmm. Because now I feel like it can impact a lot of people in vet med and do, you know, kind of coach them to be, have better systems in place, be happier at work. All the things that we both talk about a lot rather than just in that little microcosm. But the microcosm was a good lab.
Yes.
To say this, these things work, right? I know these things work because I lived in that space for 20 years. I know how to retain a team. I know how to be efficient. I know how to set boundaries for my doctors and my staff. I know to get how to go to lunch and to the bathroom when you're at work. I know how to get that done. So yeah. Let me go teach some other people how to do that. So when you were thinking about, you know, starting a business, tell me where you went to say, here's the thing, the purpose that I mm-hmm. want to have in life when I start this business.
Well, I had already, I don't know how else to explain it, Debbie, except to say that I feel like I didn't seek out compassion fatigue. I feel like it came knocking on my door. Mm. I had paid attention because I had all my own mental health issues. I've, you know, had disorders and addictions and stuff like that I've had to overcome. And I've done a lot of self-help and I've done a lot of professional help. You know, a lot of personal development. And I have always been paying attention to, there's nothing that inspires me more than other people overcoming struggles. And I had always been paying attention to the landscape of veterinary medicine. Now, before I ever worked in a practice, my own family veterinarian committed suicide. Yeah. I just tucked that in the back of my mind to be like, whoa, that's heavy. And there was nothing more to be made of it. It was a long time ago. It was way before we were talking about suicide and all that. But then when my journey took me, you know, calling on veterinary practices through all those companies that I worked with day in and day out, making sales calls, meeting veterinarians and veterinary professionals, then some of my own customers were dying by suicide. And I just kind of kept sticking that in the back of my mind to be like, what's going on here? What's the problem and what's the solution? And not to say that either of those are easy or simple. They're not, right? Suicide's complicated and there's not an easy solution. But so as I kind of felt as though I was inquisitive and curious about what was going on. Compassion fatigue, I started to get interested in. I was taking some courses just on the side. I was just trying to increase my own knowledge. Like literally in that hotel, when I thought, what am I going to make this mean and what's my next step? It became very obvious. There was this training in Canada to become, certified in compassion fatigue. And I was like, that's what I'm going to do. I don't know where it's going to take me, but that's what I'm going to do. And it felt like, synchronicity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes the light reveals itself. And I know that, when I started my business, I was, I could do everything, right? Because you're in practice management, you're a generalist, right? You focus on everything. But I found that, I didn't really love the math. I could do the math, but it's not where my passion is. Some people love that stuff. And I've always focused on the people because the people were where I felt the impact could be. And so you kind of drift over into what is truly your thing, right? The thing that you're very excited about and that you work on a lot. And so I still randomly get asked to write inventory articles and I'm like, sure, I do this, but there's people who are better suited to write inventory articles than I am. So in setting up your business, Julie, think about like how you, from that elevator epiphany, how did you start to work the problem, right? How did you set up the business? How did you move forward, make your contacts out in the world and say, this is what I'm going to do? Because I don't think that it was as prevalent, 10 years ago as it is today. I mean, it's kind of, now it's like everybody's talking about it.
Right.
When you started, there wasn't that many people talking about it.
No one was talking about it. I just felt, to me, I just saw a vision and I saw a path and I was like, this is something we need to be talking about. I remember telling my husband, first of all, I remember telling him what compassion fatigue was. And I remember, and he was like, that's interesting. But he was terrified of like, could you make a business out of this? Could this be something you could, make a living at? And I was like, sit down, take some notes, watch what this girl's going to do. Right. And I didn't really know myself either. I'm like, I'm figuring it out as I go along. But what I just started to do was all of a sudden I was like, well, here are the things that I know. I know how to train veterinary professionals. I mean, that became part of my day in and day out. And I was like, I know how to train them on things. And I have tons of contacts because I've been in the industry for 15 plus years. I'm just going to start reaching out to people to be like, hey, here's what I'm doing now. Here's what compassion fatigue is. Here's why you should care about it. Can I come in and do a lunch and learn? And here's how much it will cost.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not forget that part. You don't have a business if you're not making any money. That's the distinction.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. So that, very similar to me. I mean, the network of all those reps, the people who you've been, I always tell people, be really good to your sales reps because they're just, first of all, they're just doing their job and you should help them any way that you can.
Yeah.
And they will help you right back. So getting started, that was it. These sales reps said, hey, we know what you can do. We've been watching you do it for a long time. Let's put you to work. And it sounds like the same path for you, that the industry people really stepped up and they're looking to bring value to their customers too, mm-hmm. other than here's a, 4x4s at 10 cents a piece or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So, I think that's, some of the big mistakes that I see in practice management, I think, is not making time to talk to people, to talk to the sales reps, to, make connections with those people because you don't know what life is going to throw you. Mm. And the connections are what gets you propelled forward so many times. And it's a really, really small industry, as we know. So that never burning your bridges thing is absolutely should be written in gold across our foreheads. Don't burn it.
Absolutely. And I was schooled in that when I was working as a veterinary assistant, I was doing all the inventory. And I remember my boss had said to me, like you value your reps because they have so much value. They're going to how many practices every single day. Mm-hmm. So I totally understood that and then was privileged to become one.
Yes. Yes. I want to talk a little bit about being a rep because I think in in this industry, it seems like a lot of people are thinking that if you move over into industry instead of being in practice every day, that it's like going into nirvana. And in talking to some people who have actually been out and done that work and done industry work and worked in big corporations or work even for government entities like the CDC, I found that they're just as stressful as working in the practice. And they can be just as stressful because there's a different dynamic, but it's still people dynamic. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that? I mean, is that, you can't escape people no matter where you go, right? The problems are the problems.
Well, it's not only you, you're right. You can't escape the people. And if you're bringing your brain from job to job and you haven't changed your line of thinking, you will encounter the same emotional states and the same problems because this is what I teach as a coach. It's like I'm teaching, it's never the circumstances that are causing how we feel. It's always what we're thinking. So unless we've changed our narrative, you're right. We go then to work for a large company, work for a pharma company. And if we haven't figured out, you know, how to believe in ourselves, how to connect to people, how to give people the benefit of the doubt and have empathy. If we haven't figured all that stuff out, I mean, we will keep going from job to job to job, searching for the happiness because we think the happiness is in the job. The happiness is not in the job. No. Happiness is inside.
Happiness is here.
There you go.
Yeah, I always laugh because you see one of the questions I used to love to ask in interviews, like, you know, why did you leave your last job? And if they left because, you know, somebody in family moved or I wanted to better my career, those are legit. Mm-hmm. But, oh, those people were so toxic. Yeah. And then, well, what about the one before that? Oh, those people were so toxic. And you go, you know, maybe it's you.
I see a common denominator here.
There is right. Really a path that seems very consistent through all these job changes is that everybody around you is toxic. It might be you.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think having that self-awareness is certainly something that I think coaching can help a lot. And we don't really talk that much about it. And, you know, as somebody, I have worked with a coach for just a brief period of time. I thought it was extremely helpful to get some clarity about some stuff that I wanted to do. And tell us a little bit about coaching. Like I don't think people really understand how coaching works.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I think that we're kind of used to the therapy model, which is a great model. And here's the way that I sort of differentiate between therapy and coaching. I think therapy is for when we are stuck in our life and we are to some degree, you know, just kind of can't get out of our own way. And therapy is hugely impactful and helpful. I think coaching is for when we are living a life and we see a future that we want to be different than what we have right now. And coaching is so much more future focused about where I want to be, how I want to feel, what I want my life to be like. And therapy tends to, we dig through the past and we try to figure some stuff out and figure out why we are the way we are and why we did the things we did and why other people did. Hugely important, hugely helpful, but kind of two different things. And I have many clients who have a therapist and work with me, that's great too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, coaching is so much about where we are today and where you want to get to. That's how I see the main difference. And it's a lot about learning how your brain works.
Oh, yeah.
And the narrative and the story we're telling ourselves and our limiting beliefs and all of that.
Absolutely. Well, one of my kind of sideline geek out topics is neuroscience and how the brain works. And I've given a lot of lectures on it because once you understand it, you can just like stop yourself in mid spiral and go, brain, just that's a lie. That is a freaking lie. Shut up.
Right.
And it is so, so helpful to know that that limbic response is going to kick in. Fear raises its head and tells you this lie that you can't, you know, I can't do these things. And it makes us risk avoidant. I am risk avoidant because I will not ride a roller coaster. It kills my husband. He loves everything like that. Anything dangerous, fast, whatever. And so I will avoid those kind of things because to me, logically, they don't make sense to do that. It's a very logical thinker. But when it comes to career, I will put myself out there. And I think that's where the fear is, right? For so many people is taking that risk of pushing yourself out there and going, oh, well, they wouldn't want me to come and talk about compassion fatigue. They wouldn't want me to, you know, be a coach or listen, you know, to my ideas about their coaching. But that's not true. You know, that people are willing to listen and they do need the help and they are willing to reach out if you make the offer. But a lot of times we don't offer, right?
Right. I mean, you know, it's become quite a rarity. Why coaching, I think, is so helpful is that it has become a rarity for us to give each other a fair amount of one-on-one time. Like we are very distracted in our life today. There's something always, especially in vet med, right? It's like, you know, we have these phones that are constantly dinging at us and telling us what to do and bossing us around. And there's always something else that needs us. And especially for women, which are, you know, mostly who I coach, it's like, there's so many things on their plate, so many things vying for their attention that it's very hard for us to give each other that one-on-one.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I was thinking this the other day, now this is not to advocate for people smoking. However, if you think about back in the day when more people smoked,
yeah,
they would go and take a break.
Yeah.
And then other people would go out and then maybe two of them would go take a break and they'd chat for like 5 minutes while they were smoking and they would come back inside. And I thought, wow, you know, only like 14% of the population now smokes. So what did we lose by that? I mean, obviously we gained a great deal of healthier people, but what did we lose by that? And that was that sense of urgency that I needed to go and take a break.
Yeah.
And that one-on-one time with other people where you just kind of sit with your coworkers and chat for a few minutes and then come back inside and hit it again. But it still gave your mind a little bit of a break. It, you know, you were outside because you couldn't smoke in the building. And so there was a positivity to the fact that people smoked and took a break. Again, not saying we should start smoking again, but I'm just saying we should have that awareness and maybe even schedule break times into our days when we're working, because those times are important. Now, I used to say, okay, go one at a time because then you'll come back fairly quickly, or no more than two, one from one department, one from the other. If three of you are out there, it turns into a party and you're gone for 10 minutes. So no, three of you cannot go at the same time. But those are the things that connected us to other people. And I think that connectivity is what we are losing in the fact that I watch young people, and I say this from a long lens of life, chatting with each other over phone, sitting in the same room. Knowing what I know about the brain and how humans evolved to connect, we are connecting, but we're not connecting. Right. We are just talking at each other, but we're not talking with each other. And there is a huge difference in that. You know, when you really dig deep into, you know, how you're feeling about stuff and looking for guidance from others and having a deep conversation. And until we realize the mistake that we've made with the digital stuff and get back to being humans again, mm-hmm. I think our mental health problems are going to continue to be exacerbated.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I think that is a, you know, like that is like, we're so driven for that connection. Right. And there's like faux connection right now. So I think it's very confusing to the brain. Cause it's like, well, we're connected on social media and I see these people posting things and I respond and we think, and it's faux connection. And I'm not saying, you know, like, is there value in some of that? Of course, but to your point, there is so much more value in, you know, the physical proximity or the phone call or the undistracted or just the chit chat, like you're talking about, mm-hmm. that we have lost. Mm-hmm. We have absolutely lost. And while I'm not promoting smoking either, the only good part was our body gave us a signal to say, it's time to tag out.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we don't have that. So, or if we do, we ignore it because mm-hmm. it's not really you know, tapping us on the shoulder hard enough. So we ignore it all day long and we don't ever.
Yeah. Yeah. I picked up another a book I've had for a long time that's called First Things First. And it's a Stephen Covey book. Mm. And it was written in 1994. And it's amazing to me how so much of the content is still playing out.
Yeah.
And the thing that he talked about in the very first chapter was having an urgency addiction, where you are crisis addicted. And when you feel like you're not always in crisis mode, like putting out a fire, that you're not doing anything, that you're not being productive in your life. And so looking at, he kind of makes a grid of what's urgent and has to be the fire that puts out, you know, the angry client or the building's on fire or something's dying. Yeah. But the other things that we need to do, like having a coach or spending time to learn about how our brain is working, or, you know, just taking that time to go out and do something physical, like a walk or digging in the yard. My gardening is my therapy. Mm-hmm. But those things are just as important as the urgent putting out the fire, but we don't give them that sense of urgency in our lives. And we miss so much. And then there's the time wasters that, you know, we sit scrolling aimlessly through social media posts or watching a TV show that we've seen three times already, and or binge watching something when we could be in that important category and making connections with other people or talking to people to get some feedback about, you know, a challenge that we have with our lives, that we have our priorities wrong. And I think that's what coaching helps a lot. And in my experience, that was, it's talking to somebody who helps you focus your priorities.
Yeah. And it's like holding yourself accountable to what you say you want in your life, right? Because we are all like, well, I really want to, you know, I want to work on my mental health, or I really want to up my self-care. It's like we say these things, or I want to create some boundaries. And I really, we know what we want, but then life gets hard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kind of, we were like a turtle who like comes out of the shell, and they're like, oh geez. And we go back into the shell, and because we're afraid and we don't know how to overcome the fear, we don't know how to change the thinking to actually help us, you know, to get what we want. And there's another thing that I think coaching really helps for, is like, oh, now there's somebody else who's going to be asking me, hey, you remember that thing you said you wanted? How's that going? What are we doing about that? Where are we getting stuck? What's happening there?
Well, when I consult with practices, I come back every 3 months, and most consultants don't do that. And the reason I come back is I laughingly call it the Weight Watchers theory of practice consulting, because it is accountability, right? So I'm coming back, and one of my managers said, Debbie, you know, when we know you're coming back, we start to work on the stuff you told us to work on, because we're going, Debbie's coming. She said, but we say it with love.
You're like the aha inspection that comes around every 3 months.
Exactly. But, and my husband goes, well, nobody else does that. Why do you do that? And I went, because nothing will happen if I don't. And I want them to be successful. And so, yes, it's more difficult for me, but I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it for them. Right. And sure, I mean, I could dial in it, but I don't want to. I want to be there and I want to help them. And I also want to hold them accountable. And that, again, is very much like coaching, is like, did you do what you said you were going to do?
Yeah.
You know, but going back to I want to work on my mental health. I want to work on my physical health. I think some of the things that I found that coaching helped me with was creating a system that works. Mm-hmm. And like when I was talking to Elaine, I said, you know, I need to move more. I'm sitting way too much to do all this work that I'm doing, because I spend a lot of time writing and doing presentations. And she said, well, what would like one simple thing that would help you? And I went, you know, if I put my tennis shoes on the first thing in the morning, then at any moment in time when I had a break, I could go out and walk around. And she said, well, then why don't you put your tennis shoes on in the morning? I went, well, you know, and it was my own epiphany, but she coached me into doing it.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I put my tennis shoes on. Now, this morning, I'm standing in my bedroom shoes because I have trashed my office because I got a new desk. And so I'm going to spend some time like organizing myself because I can't work. But, you know, it's about having just a little bit of a plan, a small change that helps you. You know, it's like some people sleep in their gym clothes, you know, to go work out. Well, right. Whatever little plan, you know, you and I both have managed hospitals. And I think one of the things I find is that practices develop habits just like humans do. And some of those habits were fine 20 years ago, but those habits don't work now. And we suffer to change, right? We really suffer to change. So you've got to have sometimes outside eyes coming in and going, you know, you really, really don't need to be doing this because automation is doing it for you. And now you're just doing things. And that system is causing frustration to your team. And you go in and you work with practices. And I'm sure you find that a lot of times the frustrations of the team are the fact that they're doing stuff that doesn't make any damn sense, right?
Like 15-minute appointments, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, you know, I mean, there may be situations, but even stuff like that makes no sense.
No.
It makes no, there's nothing you can accomplish. I mean, yes, there's, we could all agree there'll be specific scenarios that 15 minutes would be fine, but not for a sick patient. No. That's what we used to do.
No.
Long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, I mean, I worked in the day when we didn't even take appointments.
Well, there you go.
So there you go. So there was no time allotment for anything. It was Katie barred the door and everybody came in.
Right.
But then again, we were staying 2 hours after work to try to get caught up. So, you know, it's setting up logic too, that says this is a system that works.
Yes.
The system supports the mental and physical well-being of your hospital. You know, I've been in, I don't even know how many hospitals now, and you've been in 10 million too, but a simple thing like a rolling stool. Now, why don't we have a mechanic stool in the treatment room where we could sit and draw a jugular stick and not break our backs every dang day? Why don't we support the physical well-being of our team like that? And just, you know, it's a simple $50 fix.
Right.
And we don't do stuff like that because we don't think about it. You know,
we don't think about it, you know, and it's funny because I was just writing in the email. I sent out an email to my list on every Monday and every Friday. And the one I sent out today was talking about, because it's been, I mean, I live in upstate New York. We've been in the 90s, high 90s for the last week. That's hot for us. I know down south, you guys are like, please hold my beer. But for us, we're like dying up here. And I was thinking about, you know, when you work with animals, it exposes you to all sorts of and even in vet med, like small animal practice, somebody's going out and walking those dogs in the 90, you know, or going out into the parking lot and helping the client, whatever. But so I was thinking about the physical uncomfortableness as well as the emotional, but as it relates to the physical, what you're talking about is like laying on the ground, breaking our backs, leaning over these wet tables that were made for 6'5" men and not for 5.5, whatever I am, 5'4". Like all of this stuff, a rolling stool, like why are we harming ourselves, right? Like
when it's not that hard to fix.
It's not.
It takes thinking outside the box.
Yes, and prioritizing ourselves.
How can we, you know, how can we make physical life better? Yeah. Because I think about like grumpy old people, and old people hurt, right? I mean, I'm getting ready to turn 66. My knees hurt, my back hurts, if I sleep wrong, it's like, oh crap. But that makes you grumpy. And so if we are physically in pain, then we are also mentally suffering because it's always dragging you down. When you hurt, when you're sick, you don't feel mentally well either. So if we could help support the physical part of our jobs, I think that we would also support the mental part of our jobs. You know, we were really fortunate at our practice in that we had a walking trail behind our hospital. And every now and then we would just get a group of us, we go walk down the trail, and you know, if the weather was nice, we go walk. But those are things that were encouraged. And I haven't been in a management position since 2008. So it's not new, but why don't we think about these things, you know? We just think about, you know, vaccinating animals and getting running through and as many as we can. And I'm a little concerned that we are, as a consultant, that we are too numbers driven.
Well, that is interesting for you to say.
Uh-huh. Yeah. because, you know, I managed and I looked at numbers, but I didn't drive people by the numbers. I drove people, not at all. I celebrated the success of our hospital in how bonded our clients were to us and the words of praise that came in. And the money shows up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's the funny thing about when you're talking about mental health and well-being, it's like the big, you know, curve in the road, so to speak, is that, well, how do we measure that, right? Because everyone's like, well, I mean, Julie, if we want to make a well-being room, or, you know, we want to put some yoga mats in and this, that, and the other thing, it's like, you know, our brain immediately goes to how that's going to take away from productivity and efficiency versus adding to it. And it's hard because we don't have the numbers to be like, well, Dr. So-and-so, here's what we do know. You know, employees, team members that spend 15 minutes in the employee well-being room, we actually find out when they go back on the floor, they are more productive by 26.3%. Like, we don't have that.
Mm-mm.
So we have to kind of, we just have to use our, there's where we can use some of our common sense and exactly. just believe.
Yeah, exactly. You know, sometimes it, going back to using your hospital as a laboratory, and what's the harm if it doesn't do any good, right? I mean, it's a couple of yoga mats you can buy at TJ Maxx for like $10. So what have you invested other than the fact that your team knows that you care and want to help?
Yeah.
And that alone is a huge boost to morale. The fact that somebody in charge wants to help.
Yeah.
And that they've put something in place to try, you know, just to try. And will all people appreciate that? No. You know, there's going to be people out there who go, I'm not doing any freaking yoga. Have you lost your gym mind?
Right.
But the others will go, oh man, you know, I would really love to go and just do a couple of stretches before I get back on the floor. And it would really help me, you know, get my mind right, or just go and just, you know, take a few breaths and calm down a little bit after a difficult encounter with a client or something stressful like a euthanasia or something highly emotional that you could go and just regroup a little bit. You know, it's the smoking a cigarette, right?
Exactly.
That's what has to happen, or did used to happen after those events. You know, people just decompressed a little bit, and now they don't really have what they consider to be a physical excuse to do it.
Right.
There's an excuse to do it, and it should be encouraged.
Yes. You know, I mean, the future, if we want to look at the future of vet med, it's like, as we, you know, as you and I talked about, the way that I just always say this, and I probably need a better way of saying it, but I'll just say it how I normally say it. The value of the pet has increased significantly.
Yes.
In other words, the human animal bond has strengthened. These pets, they're not just it's not just a dog anymore. It's our child. And that trend is not going away.
Uh-uh.
Definitely not in my lifetime. And as that puts more stress and strain on veterinary professionals emotionally, physically, we have to be looking at what we can be doing and what message we are sending to our team to be like, hey, you know what? We recognize this is tough work for you. Emotionally, it's physically draining. And there is this little room over in the corner. I'll be honest with you. Sometimes I shouldn't say that I don't care if anyone uses it. I actually do care if someone uses it, because just the room being there, yes, it sends a message, but also just the fact that you think highly enough about yourself to say, you know what, I'm tagging out for 10 minutes. I'm going to go in there and do a downward facing dog, which will change the way I feel physically, or going to go in there and sit quietly. Like, that has to be part of the interweavings of vet med as we look ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, we look at fear-free for pets. And so much of the behavior study that we do for animals, we can move over into our team. And when I'm talking to veterinary teams and I talk about humans, the limbic brain responses, I'll ask about the fear-free people and I go, yeah, I went, it's the same response. So if we look at the things that we do to calm pets down, and that is playing soothing music, why not?
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason. We play music in our hospital all the time. And mostly it was classical or something, you know, kind of a little jazzy, or, you know, it was probably a Muzak station, but it was chosen to be calming. And it calms the clients too. I walk into a treatment room one day in an emergency hospital, and they were playing some kind of like kind of headbanging stuff. I know it, folks, you know, I know that you like enjoy this music, but I will tell you from fear-free studies that this causes fear in your patients, and you're trying to get them to be relaxed so that they can heal. And so a better choice would be classical or reggae. You choose. Yes. Which one. And they went, no kidding. And sure enough, 15 minutes later, because they cared about their patients, and they went back and the music was playing, and they were playing some kind of like Bob Marley stuff, which is fun. But we could do that stuff because it makes us, we all are stimulated by music. We all, memory is brought back in Alzheimer's patients by music. And so when we can put positive connotations in to our environment with simple things like music, having food available and not crap food. And it was the other thing. I mean, you were a sales rep, but I used to tell my sales rep, do not bring that garbage into my hospital. We don't want our team to be eating, you know, donuts and pizza and stuff all the time. Bring us something like fruit, bring us something healthy. And people would just scarf that down. It was like they were starving for healthy things, but nobody ever offers it to them because everything else is like cheap. So we can set boundaries like that for our teams too. It says we want you to have healthy things available to you. And it's a big thing that people can do for their teams. And so if you are fear-free certified, just look at some of the things that we do and do that for the humans in your world. It'll help with your clients. It'll help with your team. It'll help, you know, you. You know, and doing good things for people is an endorphin rush, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it makes us feel really good. I always remember watching Michael J. Fox, and I don't know if you were at VMX when he was the keynote speaker, but it stuck with me, and it stuck with me for years. He fell going up the stage, and those metal platforms have those kind of grippy things in them. And so he scratched his hands all up and he was bleeding. And we got to the podium. He was standing there with Parkinson's tremors, and he was holding onto the podium and his hands were bleeding. And he said, I don't feel sorry for myself. And he said, but you know how you not don't feel sorry, go do something for somebody else. And then you won't feel sorry for yourself because it makes you feel good. And I went, oh my God, you know, if you can stand up in front of all these people and go, this is how you do life.
Yeah.
Then this is how we should be doing it.
That's right. What a pivotal moment to teach a lesson. Yeah. Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, so Julie, what do you consider to be your biggest career mistake looking back now?
Oh boy. You know, would have to say that I guess part of my belief system is like, I don't feel like there were any mistakes. I feel like the things I thought were mistakes at the time turned out to not be mistakes. So, you know, and I know that sounds like such a like kitschy, like life coach answer, like there's no mistakes, just opportunities, everybody. But I really have no regrets. Like I really have no regrets of my career. Like every single thing has led me to this place. Mm-hmm. Every single thing, even the day I quit on my Howard Johnson's job with no notice, which not totally proud of, but I knew I needed to get out of there. I was on for bigger and better things.
It's true. You know, life is like, it's kind of like Legos. You just start with the foundation and the blocks. You know, right. And sometimes things don't fit and you have to start the tower over again, but that's okay, because by the time it's all done, you've built a pretty cool life if you kind of paid attention to what your purpose is. You know, what's your big picture stuff, and what are you passionate about? What do you feel like you're contributing? What's the legacy you want to leave behind you? You know, I think a good exercise for all people are to write their own eulogy.
Mm.
And think, what would you want to have people say about you when you're gone? And did you do good in the world? And that's the way we kind of want to want to leave it. And that, you know, again, it's the perspective of age, because when you're 20, I wasn't thinking about writing my eulogy. I was thinking about surviving and making a living. But it's never a bad exercise. You know, it really isn't. So obviously, networking helped you tremendously. And I think that, you know, we talked about the value of creating a network of people. I wanted to ask you, because we touched a little bit on fear. Do you think that sometimes people don't network? And sometimes I think people think network is like glad handing and used car salesman stuff, but that they don't reach out to talk to people that they're really interested in getting to know or having a conversation with because they're afraid to do it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, I think fear is whether they're fear of, what are we afraid of? We're afraid of the uncomfortableness of the ask. Sometimes it's that, or we're afraid of the rejection, right? Or we're afraid, but mostly, but it's even, we're not even afraid of the rejection. We're afraid of what we will make it mean if we get rejected, because someone saying no is not a problem. What's a problem is then thinking, oh, they don't think I'm more, like, I just invited someone to be on my podcast and I didn't know if she was going to say yes or no. If she said, she said yes, but if she said no, it would still come back to, then what would my story be about that? Oh, she doesn't think I'm worthy enough. You know, that's where all the fear is. Mm-hmm. Fear is, again, what we will do to ourselves.
Yeah. Oh God. Oh, excellent. It's just such an excellent point, because it is intimidating to walk up to people that you admire and start a conversation with them. And sometimes you just have to like take a deep breath and go, what's the worst thing that could happen? Right.
I know.
She could walk away and ignore me. Okay. Well, right. I'll live through it. You know, I'll live through it. Sometimes when I'm teaching class, and of course you were in sales, so you know that some of you have to ask for the sale, right? So I look around and I'm teaching about wellness plans and talking to clients about wellness plans. And we're like, I want you to say no out loud. And everybody in class, no. I said, louder, no. Three times, loud, no. I went, now look around. And they're like, oh, what? I went, look, nobody died, right?
Right.
So everybody's still here. It's false fear that we have that no is going to just be devastating to us. It's not like you're asking them to marry you and they say no. That's pretty devastating. Right. But for just like, do you want a wellness plan? That's not that devastating. So again, asking people, and you know, most of the people I can truly say, I've talked to hundreds of strangers in my life. This is just kind of the thing I do. And I'm one of those people who talks to people on airplanes and everybody goes, oh, I know. But I found the most fascinating people sitting beside me in airplanes. And I just am fascinated with humans. I just think that, you know, how did you get from A to B is a fascinating story.
Yeah.
I don't tell people on airplanes that I'm in animal health, because then I see 2 hours of dog pictures and you can't get away from it. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the people I've met are so interesting. And I think that the key to reaching out to people and having them you know, accept that outreach is that I'm so interested in you, not what you can do for me, but I'm just really interested in you and how you got to where you were. And I want to know about you. So if you kind of go into these things where you're interested in having a conversation with somebody, go in with curiosity, and I guarantee you 99% of the time you will never get rejected.
Right. And you know, like, that is such the pathway to empathy, is curiosity, right? It's like, and it's one of those things, like, first of all, we have to forget everything that we know in order to be curious about someone else. We have to, like, and I'm so amazed. I'm like you, I'm an introvert, but yet I kind of feel like I'm a professional extrovert because I speak on lots of stages and things like that. But like, I am always fascinated. I'll be honest, the most amazing, fascinating people I've ever met are Lyft drivers and taxi drivers. Like, I can talk to those people, and I have written emails and podcasts, and like, I am like blown away. But when you're interested in people, just for the sake of everybody has a story, mm-hmm. it all of a sudden you get to see, no matter how different we may appear. Maybe our skin color is different, our gender is different, our identity is different, our sexual orientation, all that stuff, where we live, it may look different on the outside, but man, oh man. And this is what I have learned, you know, also being a coach, is that you strip it all down, we are very alike.
Yes.
We yeah. all have the same fears, and you're talking about fear here. Most of our fears are about feeling inadequate, feeling like we're not enough. And I'm telling you, you find that even in people that you think we put on these pedestals, they're like, you know, Oprah, she's so self-confident, all that stuff. Guess what? You have a conversation with Oprah, she'll reveal that for you just as well. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When you go into conversation with people looking for similarities rather than differences,
yeah.
then I think if we could just shut up our politicians or either coach them, maybe we should coach Congress. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you know, they're intentionally driving a wedge, and I hope that the public wises up. I hope that enough messaging gets out from people like you who says, look, we really are very similar. We all want to, you know, protect our environment. We want to do good in the world. We want to protect our families. We want to live comfortably.
Yeah.
They're all things that everybody wants. You know, we want to, but if we don't work together, because humans are tribal, we have always evolved in tribes of collaborativeness. And if we stop collaborating with each other, our survival is doomed. So we really do need to understand that, you know, in a microcosm, it's an animal hospital, but in the macro, it's our entire world. And we got to all play nicely in the sandbox together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. And that is that one place where, you know, it's like we have to remember it's not the veterinary team against the clients. It's like we're all in this together. I'm a client. Trust me. You know, I may have a slightly different perspective, but yet my perspective is of the same of all of your other clients, which is first and foremost, I'm afraid about what's going on. I'm afraid of, you know, why I'm there. And it's really important because I'm in a very vulnerable state, that if all of a sudden, like, I am met with what appears to be judgment, or I am met with some sense of what feels like disconnection, I mean, it just goes terrible from there.
Mm-hmm. It does. And that's what spirals down into these conflagrations, for yeah. lack of a better word, when clients come in and they get so angry. I yeah. often, you know, I see all these things. I see all these, like there was a fight at Disney in the parking lot or something, I think, yesterday. And I always want to dial it back to where it started and what cues were missed in communication that could have stopped it, mm. that could have reversed it or calmed it, because I know that they're there.
Yeah.
And I'm, cause I'm way, the way I look at things, I know that they're there, but that's a lifetime of experience working with the public. But what went wrong? You know, where did it go? I mean, I laughed. I saw something, somebody threw an alligator inside a window of a Wendy's because they got their order wrong. I mean, this was somewhere down in Florida, an alligator. And then they were charged mm. with assault with a deadly weapon. Mm. You can't make this stuff up, but then why? And what was the backstory of that? Had this woman been to this same restaurant four times and every single time they got her order wrong? You know, and was this the straw that broke the camel's back? So what happened before? You know, and sometimes it's not anything that we have anything to do with. We right. have to realize right. that it is not us. It, right. It's happened before they got in our door, but right. then we could empathize with that.
Right.
And help that client, and even let them vent a little bit if they need to, but not taking it personally, because we need those skills that don't let us get sucked into the emotion, right? We want to step back and be working the problem instead of being involved in the problem.
And we can't do that. As soon as we think it's about us, we start taking it personally. And you're right, like, talk about the brain just goes right into, you know, like our primitive brain is turned on, and we are now, you know, it's about survival. Mm-hmm. Like, we can't possibly be connecting with someone when our brain is in that you know, fight or flight and survival mode.
Yes, exactly.
Just isn't going to happen.
Because the smart part is...
Yeah, right. Non-accessible.
It does. It does. Well, Julie, our time is slipping away here. And I know you and I could really, oh my gosh, we need to give like 5 hours of lecture together.
I know, we could.
We could. But I do want to ask, you know, just as a coach, understanding compassion fatigue in the workplace that we live in, what advice would you give about somebody who is trying to make this career decision, life decision, you know, stay in vet med, get out of vet med, change mm-hmm. positions, go to industry? I mean, choices are hard. What path would you put them on?
I think I would put them on the path of self-discovery. I think that, you know, there are systems out there that aren't working, that are not conducive to well-being. But I also think that compassion fatigue, veterinary medicine is, to me, it's like this beautiful doorway into self-discovery of figuring out what are my needs and can I ask for those needs? Can I advocate for myself? Do I know how to take care of myself, mind, body, and spirit? Like, where do I need to say no? Where do I need to say this isn't good for me? And where do I need to say, yeah, this is a great opportunity? Or, you know what? I'll give you, you know, all of me Monday to Thursday, but Friday is my day off, or whatever that might be. And being willing to ask for and communicate to others what I'm going to need to do to take care of myself mm-hmm. so that I can give at the highest level and, you know, make the difference that I want to make in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always like to ask my guests to tell us a fun fact. So what are some things that people might be surprised to learn about you?
Surprised to learn about me. What would you be surprised to learn about me? Maybe you would be surprised to learn about me that I feel like, well, you might be surprised to learn about me, like, I love Netflix. Like, Netflix is like Netflix is part of my self-care. I'm not kidding you. Like, I don't binge watch anything, but I tell you, I dabble. And I'll tell my husband, going to watch my show now. And it's like just sort of like a little cocoon where I just get to decompress. I think, you know, might surprise people about me is that, you know what, like, I'm a life coach, but I'm a hot mess too, right? I don't have my life all together. There are days where I literally like say things to myself like, girl, really? Like, that's the best you can do today? That's all you got? Like, really? That's who you want to be today? You're going to be that version of Julie? All right. And I work hard to not judge that. And yeah. Sometimes I'm better at that than others.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to let your defenses down and you're like, oh, yeah. I really should have not done that. I should have rethought that before I said it.
I don't have to be perfect, right? It's like, that would make me very boring if I thought that I was better than anyone else. It's like, I'm not better than anyone else. I'm a human being with a brain that gets me in trouble.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I get it. I totally get it. I'm there with you. Anything that you would like to say about, you know, yourself, your company? How do people get your coaching? And is it one-on-one? You come into clinics? Tell us a little bit about Rekindle.
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking about Rekindle. Rekindle, I'm just sort of in this place of, you know, my business. I've had my business now for 8.5 years, and it's like anything else. I've figured out who my business is, right? Because my business is an entity, right? Just like yours. And then how I interact with that and figuring out what are the things that I like to do. And I started a veterinarian group coaching program about 6 months ago that really having a great time doing, where I'm coaching veterinarians in a group setting and we're learning things. That's been amazing. I still do one-on-one, and I still do some, you know, come to your practice or your organization and do training. So website, rekindlesolutions.com. That's the best place to find me. And my contact information is there too, but thanks for asking, Debbie.
And we'll put all that stuff in the show notes, because I absolutely believe that people will benefit from getting in contact with you and using your services. And, you know, we've kind of talked about, you know, the similarities in what we do, but for me, I kind of work with the entire team to put the systems and coaching in place. And you really help a lot of individuals in that group setting to become the best version of themselves and to get out of their own way to success. So I really appreciate what you do. I think we're, you know, we're working towards a good path in VetMed. It's difficult. It's hard work, but there are a lot of good people working on it. And that encourages me because the conversation is there and where it has not been before. So awfully glad that it's happening.
Agreed. And I always say that I don't work on the whole practice because I'm not smart enough to help implement changes for the whole practice. I have to just work with individuals. I don't know how to, like, I love that there are people like you that can work on an entire practice and figure out what they need to do. I'm like, wow, that's way above my pay grade.
Well, there are some practice owners that I would definitely turf over to you for one-on-ones. Because a lot of times we find out that the hot mess in the whole practice is coming from the top.
That's it.
But I love them. I love my practice owners and all the teams because they are, you know, they're so committed to the work that they do and they don't mean harm. They really don't.
Not at all. It's just, such a great profession. It's the best profession on earth. It is.
Profession. Yeah. Well, thank you. Once again, Julie Squires of Rekindle. And I hope that you guys do take advantage of her coaching, either one-on-one or for lunch and learn for your team, or however you can follow her, you know, get her newsletter, pay attention to what she's saying, because it's really going to help you thrive in the veterinary profession. I believe this with all my heart, and we need to be moving in a positive direction. And I think we're going there. So thank you, Julie, for that. And thank y'all for listening to this episode of The Bend. All Julie's information will be in the show notes along with her bio. So thank you and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, Debbie. This has been great. Thank you for having me on.
You're quite welcome.